The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Conversations with Peers About Type 2 Diabetes Mellitus, Best Practices for Optimizing Treatment Using Weight Management as a Primary Goal. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/WMV860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hi. My name is Javier Morales from the Donald and Barbara Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell in Hempstead. Welcome to this educational activity on initiating conversations about weight management and intensifying therapy for type 2 diabetes. Welcome to the first part of this three-part educational curriculum on targeting glycemia and weight to prevent complications in the management of people with type 2 diabetes. You can access the full curriculum at peerview.com. We have several goals to accomplish today. First is application of guidelines that prioritize weight loss as a treatment target in people with type 2 diabetes. We also hope to discuss overcoming therapeutic inertia in intensifying therapy timely and appropriately when glycemic and weight goals are unmet. And then finally, refining our shared decision-making skills to develop individualized management plans to address glycemia and weight. So there is no time like the present when it comes to intensifying type 2 diabetes management treatment to minimize some of the complications associated with type 2 diabetes. Oftentimes, what we've learned is that type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hypertension are oftentimes interrelated and connected with obesity. In fact, healthy adipose tissue oftentimes can become hypertrophied as a consequence of perhaps faulty lifestyle and dietary choices, which can lead to significant autonomic overactivity with lipid spillover and inflammation. This ultimately leads to adipocyte dysregulation, which can affect vascular tone, could also affect the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, each of these contributing towards hypertension, and can actually lead to liver inflammation, with an effect on metabolic rate, insulin sensitivity, and decreased muscle perfusion, decreasing glucose uptake, which could translate into type 2 diabetes. Now, most of the processes regulating these physiological functions are not under voluntary control at all. Now, it is important that over the years, things have shifted from being a glucose-centric clinician focusing on glucose lowering as the principal target, but rather we need to take a person-centered approach when it comes to managing patients with type 2 diabetes. And this includes addressing cardiovascular risk factors, trying to minimize hypoglycemia, focusing on weight, as well as looking at cardiovascular care. And while very complex, the American Diabetes Association did a beautiful job in terms of constructing this slide to help us along. So once again, I think when we're looking at mitigating cardiovascular risk, it's important to remember that lipid control and blood pressure control is going to be very important. Trying to avoid glycemic variability and trying to minimize hypoglycemia for those patients with established cardiovascular disease winds up being important. And considering medications that have a beneficial effect on weight seems to make the most sense, and as well as trying to avoid medications that may hurt the kidneys, but rather using medications that may actually improve cardiovascular risk, as well as reduce the risk of progression of chronic kidney disease related to diabetes. And over the years, there's been a myriad of clinical trials looking at the GLP-1 receptor agonists, in which indeed they do demonstrate safety at the very least to reduction in major adverse cardiovascular events. Now, we do know that poor glycemic control over time could lead to some of the very complications of type 2 diabetes that we're very familiar with. And this includes the microvascular complications of neuropathy, nephropathy, and neuropathy, as well as some of the macrovascular complications such as stroke and myocardial infarction, and of course, mortality, all-cause mortality. And while this slide is very complicated, it tells the story that the longer time that you spend with poor glycemic control, the greater the likelihood that you're going to succumb to some of these very microvascular, macrovascular complications, as well as increased mortality. So take-home point is that we need to achieve good glycemic control for our patients, especially if they are poorly controlled to begin with. So what about weight? Because we do know that weight also contributes towards mortality. And we do have parameters that we've defined in terms of what a normal weight should be. And that should be between 19 and 24. We're considered overweight if you're 25 to 29, obese if your BMI is greater than 30, and severely obese or morbidly obese if your BMI is greater than 40. BMIs of less than 19 would be characterized as being underweight. And what we're seeing here is the association of weight characterized as whether or not you're obese or not, and the risk of cardiovascular disease, morbidity, and mortality. So what about parameters and control, and how well have we been doing over the past years? So here's data that's been collected from the National Health and Nutrition Education Survey between the years of 2013 and 2016. And what we're seeing here is that the proportion of patients achieving improved glycemic control has improved in patients with cardiovascular disease, also with blood pressure. We're doing a great job in terms of cigarette smoking, but when it comes to helping our patients achieve normal weight, well, we're falling a little bit short there in terms of allowing our patients to achieve a body mass index of less than 30 and also less than 25. And in fact, only 9.6% of those without cardiovascular disease, and for those with cardiovascular disease, 2.7% of those patients were able to achieve optimal A1C, blood pressure, LDL, non-smoking, and a body mass index of less than 30. So we're falling short of where we really should be, and we really need to intensify that for our patients. So what are the barriers and what are the challenges that we can experience when allowing our patients to achieve those targets? Well, that's the concept of therapeutic inertia. And therapeutic inertia actually exists at multiple levels. So let's explore this at the clinician practice level. First, it's important to understand the impact of treatment inertia. We do know that we're taking care of a lot of different disease states. So perhaps scheduling diabetes-only visits, solely looking at glycemic control, reviewing glucose logs, may be very, very important. It's also important to recognize certain barriers that patients may experience. And this includes diabetes distress, depression, a thorough understanding of diabetes, and perhaps more frequent follow-up visits, particularly in poorly controlled patients, seems to be appropriate in order to achieve appropriate hemoglobin A1C targets. Developing a diabetes care plan that includes personal A1C target, it needs to be also emphasized, as well as taking into account concerns and wishes, which should be reviewed on a regular basis, because after all, life is full of changes, and those changes need to be practiced for our patients. So it is important to remember that weight loss in those who are overweight or obese is equally as important in our patients with type 2 diabetes, because of the impact that obesity does play in terms of the very many metabolic parameters that were discussed earlier in this program. As little as 5% weight loss has significant improvement in health. And when we look at a 10% weight loss, we reverse some of these very disease processes, and these include improvement in blood pressure, improvement in sleep architecture, and lipid parameters as well. And as much as a 15% weight loss reduces some cardiovascular risks, including cardiovascular events and complications. Now, when it comes to managing diabetes, we do know that it's quite complicated. We have very many medications in the toolbox. And we could see here that some of these medications are associated with significant weight gain. These include sulfonylureas and full physiologic replacement with insulin. However, some of the newer J agents, and these include the GLP-1 receptor agonists and the SGLT2 inhibitors, wind up being extremely beneficial when it comes to not just achieving good glycemic control, but also achieving weight targets. Now, when we're looking at these GLP-1 receptor agonists, and we're looking at GIP-GLP-1 co-agonists, here we could see that a lot of these GLP-1 receptor agonists are beneficial not only in achieving great hemoglobin A1C lowering, but also weight benefits. And when we're looking at as much as 2% reduction in hemoglobin A1C with as much as 10 kilograms of weight loss, we can see that the newer GLP-1 receptor agonists, these include semaglutide, are beneficial. Looking at as much as 2.5% reduction in hemoglobin A1C and as much as 15 kilograms of weight loss is actually seen with the newer GLP-1 GIP co-agonist agents. So, motivating patients with individualized management and shared decision-making will be the next topic to explore. So here we have a video looking at Dr. John Anderson interviewing a new patient, Evie Williams. Evie needs some medications refilled right away due to a change in her insurance. Her former PCP is now out of network and she really doesn't have time to discuss her weight.
Evie, I'm Dr. John Anderson. It's nice to meet you.
Hi, nice to meet you.
I know we're squeezing this in and I know you're in a hurry, but we wanted to just touch base because I know you're changing from your previous physician and wanted to at least have sort of a medical record so we can get your medications taken care of. I understand you're sort of getting to the very end of your prescription.
That's true. I only have a few pills each of them left.
Okay, and so we need to refill the losartan and then the sitagliptin metformin combination. Is that right?
That's true.
How are you doing with those medications?
So far, so good. Been no change anyway.
Okay. How have you seen your previous physician?
I think it's been about 8 years now.
Well, I apologize for insurance getting in the way of the doctor-patient relationship and you having to change, but I promise we'll try to make this as seamless as possible for you.
First of all,
any issues going on with you? How are you feeling?
No, not today. Everything's fine.
All right. And remind me which pharmacy we're using?
I'm over to the Walgreens.
And that's which part? Which Walgreens is that?
Over in Woodbine.
Okay, so it's the same one you've been using. No changes, right?
That's true.
Okay. Well, one of the things I'd like to do is set up a follow-up visit here in person so we can get to know each other and also get some lab work. I had noticed, I got a chance to briefly look at your record, and you have had a little increase in your blood pressure, A1C, and weight over the past year. Is that right?
That is right.
Okay. Do you have time today to talk a little bit about that? I mean, you know, there are some great new medicines that have weight reduction options that also treat diabetes.
Honestly, doctor, I don't have time today, but I'm open to talking at another time.
Okay. Well, tell you what let's do. Let's get you in within the next month. And because I get booked up, I'm going to have my nurse get on the phone with you and get you an appointment. I know you're a dental hygienist. Are there days of the week that are better for you?
Tuesday's the best.
Tuesday's the best? I'm sure we can do that. I'll have my nurse get on the phone with you. We'll get you a Tuesday appointment. We will. She'll walk through how to get in and out of the office with the parking and all of that type of thing. And I'll make sure we get enough for the next month to your pharmacy. Because the last thing you want to do when you're trying to change physicians is worry that you're not going to be able to get the medications you need. And I promise we're not going to let that happen to you. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, good. Have a great day. I will see you within the next month and we'll talk more about some of these issues. Okay.
That sounds good. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, it's nice meeting you. Have a nice day.
Bye-bye.
So just to review, Evie Williams, she has diabetes diagnosed about 5 years ago, and her medical history basically reveals that she's had increasing weight, glycemia, and blood pressure within the past 3 years. So our question, how would you initiate a conversation with a patient like Evie? Someone requiring weight reduction conversation, but reluctant or not engaged? Or how do you assess their readiness to change? So this is where communication within that patient encounter becomes extremely important. And there are some physical cues that the patient may give you, and there might be some verbal cues as well. So one of the great open-ended questions that we can ask is, well, is now a good time for us to discuss how your weight and health may be affecting each other and how can we work together on it? And if the patient is actually engaged, then we can actually ask her what concerns them most about their weight, what's more important in terms of hoping to achieve appropriate weight loss, and what would stand in the way of achieving that success? What is the first step that they're willing to take and what impact will this have on their life? And if they're not ready, then perhaps a phrase similar to the one that's depicted there in the slide, and very important, is the fact to keep that door open to discuss that during future visits. So here's some communication tips for patients with different approaches to self-management. So when it comes to patients, some are the take charge type that are upbeat and look towards their self. And there are some that really don't take charge, or they may feel downbeat. So let's take a look at some of those take charge, upbeat points of emphasis. So if we're going to look at points of emphasis for those who take charge, propose small steps and propose a framework. Focus on feeling good, encourage patient initiative, and allow the patient to take ownership over control of their glycemic control as well as their weight. So how about some of those patients who really don't want to take charge or may feel downbeat? Some of the points of emphasis is, again, to propose small steps, because small steps oftentimes encouraging taking additional small steps. For those who may feel downbeat, acknowledge that sentiment, be empathetic. Focusing on support from others is going to be important. And for those who do look towards others, emphasizing the role of the clinician or the doctor and emphasizing science and how beneficial science has been in establishing these very medications that have led to significant success. Now, there is a lot of stigmatization about type 2 diabetes and weight within the healthcare profession. So when it comes to clinicians' attitudes towards patients, I think most clinicians certainly do feel that patients themselves may be personally responsible for their disease state, particularly when it comes to type 2 diabetes. But when it comes to obesity, most clinicians feel that the patients own the fault or are responsible for their obesity issues. So let's go back to Evie. So here she's with her first follow-up visit with Dr. Anderson. And here we could see that her body mass index remains at 31, her height is 66 inches, her weight is 192 pounds, A1C 7.2%, hypertensive, type 2 diabetic, medications didn't change very much. And when it comes to her visit notes, she is, just as a reminder, she's a hygienist, married with two children, and really is not into making big changes. She was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes 5 years ago, and her medical history shows that she's had gradually worsening glycemic control, increasing weight, and she really wants to try lifestyle modifications to improve her glycemic control, weight, and hypertension. So the question is, should aggressive lifestyle intervention be attempted in someone like Evie prior to initiating pharmacotherapy? So we do have some essential healthy living tools or guidance that we should really give to everybody. And this is actually in the American Heart Association recommendations. And that is to eat better, be more active, stop smoking if you smoke, manage your cholesterol, manage your blood pressure, manage your blood sugar. Managing weight is very, very important, as well as getting an appropriate night's sleep on a regular basis. So what about overweight and obesity and cardiovascular risk? We did mention before that patients that are overweight and obese are at greater risk of cardiovascular mortality. So here we're looking at some data, looking at patients who are active with normal weight, inactive with normal weight, and we could see there that decreased level of activity increases, actually almost doubles, your risk of cardiovascular disease risk score. And if you are active and overweight, and active and overweight now over time, compared to inactive and overweight, we could see that lower levels of activity and the persistence of being overweight greatly increases that cardiovascular disease risk score. So just another parameter that's very important, that weight really does matter. Now, intensive lifestyle intervention winds up being extremely important for our patients. Here we're looking at data from the Look Ahead study. The Look Ahead study was a rigorous trial in which patients were enrolled with weekly contact, dietitians, an exercise program. And we can see that in those patients that were engaged and managed to lose a significant amount of weight successfully, wound up having significant reduction in hemoglobin A1C. And when we're looking at other metabolic parameters, and this includes blood pressure, we could see that there was significant reduction in systolic blood pressure, as well as diastolic blood pressure for these patients. And when we're looking at lipids, we could see that there was an increase in HDL cholesterol, as well as some changes that were favorable with LDL cholesterol. But the increase in HDL cholesterol really told a really beautiful story of how significant lifestyle intervention is in terms of improving insulin sensitivity. So what advice can we give our patients about lifestyle interventions? Well, lifestyle modifications mean different things in different contexts. When we're looking at the Look Ahead study, we could see that it was a really rigorous trial. There was a significant time commitment that was actually needed on the part of the clinician, as well as the part of the clinical practice, and frequent multidisciplinary counseling and follow-up appointments were exercised. So a practical starting point for some of these patients might be something as little as walking 175 or more minutes per week and recruiting a diabetes educator or referral to a diabetes clinical education program endorsed by clinicians as a strong predictor for how well the patients would remain engaged in such a practice. There's many fad diets that are available in terms of dietary practices, and here's some information from the American Society of Preventive Cardiology clinical practice statement. And it's important to remember to eat more polyunsaturated fats, dietary omega-3, dietary fibers, and phytonutrients, and focus less on saturated fats and trans fats, or dietary cholesterol, sodium, and calories, especially refined carbohydrates, because all of these would be instrumental in terms of achieving weight loss, controlling blood glucose, controlling dyslipidemia, and helping to control blood pressure, which further reduces that cardiovascular risk. So let's go back to Evie Williams and Dr. John Anderson. And let's explore this video clip where Evie is disappointed after her best efforts at lifestyle changes really haven't yielded the changes in hemoglobin A1C or weight that she really wanted to achieve. But she still wants to pursue some of those goals, and she's ready to listen to what Dr. Anderson has to say now.
Hi, Evie. How are you doing?
Just fine, doctor.
I see we're doing a virtual visit. Is that right?
Yeah, my car's out of commission.
I hate to hear that. I hate when that happens. All right. We talked last visit about several things, but particularly you were going to make some changes. We were going to look at blood pressure, glucoses. We're going to look at weight. How's it all going in the last 3 months?
Not too good. I mean, I have been exercising five times a week. I have been eating really well, and neither the blood pressure nor the weight has budged.
I sense a little frustration. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
One of the things I want you to do is not do a lot of self-blame, because we know that you have a lot of hormones and things that are fighting your ability to lose weight. And that's why some of these newer medications, they have both blood sugar lowering as well as weight reduction as part of their therapeutic benefit. So what would you be willing to do? Because we've got some options. We have an oral option. We have some injectable options. When I say injectable, I mean just a small needle under the skin. What would you be willing to do in terms of therapies? Do you have a preference?
I don't. I mean, I'd be open to whatever you think could work the fastest.
Okay. Well, I think some of the injectable options that are just once a week would probably be the best for you. And we have a couple of options that I'll give you. A lot of this will depend on formulary. So I may need you to check on coverage for a couple of these options, and we'll give them to you. And then I think it's going to be important for you to come into the office to get that first injection, whether you pick up the prescription and come in, or whether I have some samples still available that we can use to get started. Because I think doing that in the office gives you a little more confidence than if you were just to do it at home without anybody watching over you. Would you be able to get in the next little bit to come to the office?
Certainly.
So my nurse and I will talk to you about how to do it. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the potential for side effects like gastrointestinal, nausea, that type of thing, and how to sort of mitigate those side effects. And then what we'll do is just call the office. We'll schedule a time for you to come in, come back. We're not even going to do an office visit. We're just going to sit down with you to get you prepared to have some success with these new therapies.
All right. That sounds good.
Okay, good. Well, I look forward to seeing you in the office, and we'll hear back from you about your formulary.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate
okay,
you.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
How do we bring up the subject of therapies for weight loss? So we do know that lifestyle intervention is extremely important. And just recapping some of the information and some of the lessons that were learned from the Look Ahead study, we could see that intensive lifestyle intervention led to significant improvement in hemoglobin A1C for our patients with type 2 diabetes and a significant benefit with respect to weight. But very important in this clinical study was that there was frequent contact very early on, as much as weekly in these patients, and then they were liberalized a little bit as time went on. So that repeated encouragement winds up being extremely important in order to maintain these very beneficial changes that we see for our patients. And when we're looking at weight loss that was seen with intensive lifestyle intervention compared to those with diabetes support and education, we can see that there was significant weight loss that was noted across all of those that did practice intensive lifestyle intervention relative to those that were on the diabetes support and education group. And we could see stratified by where they are starting that a fair amount of patients were successful in terms of achieving as much as 15% or more with intensive lifestyle intervention. And we do realize how difficult it can be. But sometimes lifestyle intervention is very difficult to achieve, and medications may be required. When we're looking at medications that may have been introduced during Look Ahead, the only medication that was utilized was the fat-blocking drug called orlistat. And here we could see that even the addition of a medication like orlistat really didn't have any significant bearing on patients that were enrolled in this clinical study. And when we're looking at using these medications, medications do work, provided that you do take them. So we do know how difficult orlistat is in terms of tolerability. And for that reason, the persistence rate of patients with orlistat wound up being quite low. However, when we're looking at incretin-based therapies, it's really noteworthy to mention that medications like semaglutide and liraglutide had the greatest persistence of taking the medication relative to the other currently approved weight loss medications in the marketplace today. Now, what about the new GLP-1 GIP co-agonist, tirzepatide? So here we're looking at data across SURPASS 1 through 4, which was four different clinical trials. And here we're looking at those patients who experienced weight loss of as little or as less than 5% to those who experienced as much as 15% of weight loss. And here we could see that a fair amount of patients who did experience significant weight loss also did have significant improvement in hemoglobin A1C. The weight goes without saying, and there seemed to be a greater reduction in systolic blood pressure, as well as improvement in triglycerides in those who experienced greater weight loss. So it just goes to show the association of how important weight loss is with these very metabolic parameters that may contribute towards cardiovascular risk. And what about kidney function? We do know that patients with type 2 diabetes are at risk of developing chronic kidney disease related to that diabetes. So it's encouraging to note here that compared to insulin glargine, medications like tirzepatide and some of these very clinical trials did offer significant benefit in terms of curtailing the progression of chronic kidney disease related to diabetes. We also saw this with other GLP-1 receptor agonists, such as dulaglutide, liraglutide, and even semaglutide. In fact, semaglutide completed a dedicated trial looking at the effect of semaglutide on that progression of chronic kidney disease. And the trial was stopped early on the basis of the predefined endpoints having been achieved in this clinical trial and efficacy having been achieved. So we do know that these medications do work if you're taking them, but what if you stop taking the medication? So here's some data from a Japanese cohort, the SURPASS-J monotherapy trial. And as one would expect, the dotted line represents discontinuation of the medical therapy. Here we're looking at different doses of the medication, and we could see that discontinuation of the tirzepatide resulted in weight gain. However, it seemed that the highest dose that was utilized was associated with less weight regain. So, and also when we're looking at the parameters of hemoglobin A1C, we also saw that there was persistence of glycemic control even with the discontinuation of medication, even though there was some loss that was noted. Over the recent months and over the past year, there's been some concerns about safety with GLP-1 receptor agonist-based therapy, one of these being intestinal obstruction. And when we're looking at real-world meta-analysis, looking at over 190,000 patients, there was really no difference in the risk of intestinal obstruction of those taking GLP-1 receptor agonists, SGLT2s, or DPP-4 inhibitors. There was also no risk of pancreatic cancer in over 500,000 patients that had been reviewed. And there were some concerns about mental illness with these GLP-1 receptor agonists, and we're looking at semaglutide in general. There wound up being 73% lower risk of incident suicidal ideation and 56% lower risk of recurrent suicidal ideation in our patients that are taking these GLP-1 receptor agonists. Now, these agents are relatively large peptides and sometimes do offer immunogenicity, but the immunogenicity did not affect tirzepatide pharmacokinetics or safety. And in fact, the medication worked pretty well in terms of A1C reduction. So let's go back to Evi, and this is the case conclusion. So just to reiterate, BMI of 30.5, height of 66, A1C is 7.1% with a blood pressure of 24 over 73. Her current medications actually have changed. So now she was amenable to going on injectable therapy and was started on tirzepatide 2.5 milligrams weekly, which was then intensified to 5 milligrams weekly on the basis of the need for better glycemic control. And she is now on losartan and remains on metformin. So what are your strategies for mitigating potential side effects from GLP-1 receptor agonists or GIP-GLP-1 co-agonist? So patients may experience a little bit of nausea, which is subjective and typically happens because of delayed gastric emptying. So eating smaller servings, stop eating when feeling full, avoiding high fat and spicy foods, caution with alcohol might be really, really important. Now, even though there's significant weight loss that's noted, there might be loss in muscle mass as well. So it is important to maintain a high protein diet, exercise at least 5 days per week, and oftentimes the sense of well-being and enjoyment of food improves once that rapid weight loss slows after initiation of therapy. So it's important to also communicate potential adverse events such as GI-related symptoms that include severe abdominal pain and even perhaps ileus. So it is important to establish a virtuous cycle in comprehensive type 2 management and obesity management, and that is to achieve a goal or to define what that goal is going to be and pursue it. Set achievable, realistic goals, develop a management plans and implement that management. When that goal is met, continue working with that plan and provide encouragement. And if there is distress, well, try to mitigate that distress, encourage adherence to the plans, and new goals oftentimes need to be added. So in a clinical trial program looking at GIP-GLP-1 receptor agonist co-therapy in patients with type 2 diabetes, improved glycemic control and reduced weight was oftentimes associated with adoption of other healthful behavior. So some key takeaways are that patients have fewer complications with earlier initiation of management of their glycemic control and weight, following appropriate lifestyle intervention, which includes a nutritious diet and physical activity, are going to be foundational for our patients, not only for glycemic control, but achieving success with other parameters that affect cardiovascular risk. When it comes to managing our patients who need weight control as well as diabetes control, the greatest persistence and greatest success is noted with the GLP-1 receptor agonists and the GLP-1 GIP co-agonists. Type 2 diabetes is a self-managed disease, and oftentimes using a self-diabetes management program usually is very helpful in allowing our patients to achieve those goals that they set. I want to thank you for your time, and this concludes our discussion for today. We certainly do hope that you found the activity informative and useful to your practice, and encourage you to participate in other parts of this curriculum, which you can access at peerview.com. Again, thank you for participating.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Components of this activity have been developed in partnership with Healthcare Theater from the University of Delaware. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/WMV860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Lilly.